It's about 2 minutes after eight. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. With us so far today, we have Representative Dahl, Representative Coghill, Representative Johnson, Vice Chair Rhodes, and myself, Bob Lynn. And today on the schedule, we have, wait a second here. I'm going to see the number on here. We have HB 6, which is relates to campaign contributions, and HB 88, which relates to TV monitors and motor vehicles. We're going to start with HB 6. And would Mr. Wright come forward, please? Introduce yourself, please, and then after that, we're going to see about adopting the CS.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Wright. I'm staff to Speaker Harris, and he sends his apologies, but he had a speaking engagement this morning before the School Board Association and another one before the State Chamber of Commerce, and he's going to try to get in between those two discussions this morning, and again, he sends his apologies. Representative Mark Newman is also here, and the reason why he is within the CS, which you have yet to adopt, but you know, hopefully you will for discussion purposes, a portion of legislation he introduced is incorporated into this bill with Representative Newman's permission, and so he is also here to discuss the portion of his bill that's within the proposed CS.
Fine, thank you, Mayor. Would somebody care to make a motion to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I would move that we adopt the work draft. It's LS0055/K, dated 2107 for CS for House Bill number 6.
And I'll object for discussion purposes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to Representative Newman, who has another committee to attend, and he can discuss his portion, and then I can go over the bill and the CS after Representative Newman completes his testimony.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Representative Mark Newman. I represent District 15 in Sioux Valley. Mr. Chair, Alaskans recognize and expect disclosure. We've heard from them time and time again. This is why I originally filed House Bill 5. It is here incorporated into House Bill 6 today, and my goal was to close a few gaps in existing statutes. In May of 2003, during the 23rd legislature, Senate Bill 119 was passed, and part of that bill allowed for the exempt status to be raised from $2,500 to $5,000, and it may not seem like a lot, but it's still three times our highest permanent fund dividend check.
And would you explain for those who are watching, perhaps in gavel, what exempt status means? If I'm going to declare to run for office and I declare exempt status, what does that mean to my campaign?
Mr. Chair, candidates running for political office can file what is considered or called exempt status. In exempt status, any funds that they collect by filing exempt status, they agree that, and it is agreed with APOC, that all funds that they collect and spend that are less than $5,000, they do not have to report to the public or to the APOC, Alaska Public Office Commission.
So as long as they don't go over $5,000 in contributions received or expenditures made, is that correct?
That's correct, Chair.
Thank you.
May I ask a question?
Representative Roses.
Through the chair. Mr. Newman, on those individuals with exempt status, let's say they don't receive more than $5,000 or they don't expend more than $5,000, are there any provisions currently that exist that would prevent an outside entity from running a campaign against their opponent?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, no, there is not. And that is a critical part of what you have spoke to. There could be a particular organization could run three or four or five candidates against one particular candidate for office currently right now under this law. And this would deal with that. It would open it up to the public who is supporting these candidates and why they or how they are spending their money. And currently right now, I don't feel that money meets responsible disclosure levels. Again, the public has called for full and open disclosure. And this has been changed so it does only apply for statewide offices, that being the legislature, the governor, and lieutenant governor. That happened when it was incorporated into the House Bill 6. At the local level, I would just as soon not impose the will of the legislature or state government on the local level, so that's why we decided that we would hold this at the state level for statewide contributions. But I feel that there is a chance for corruption like that to happen. Also, along with that $5,000, is the public has no idea where this money gets spent. And so if you have candidates who run for office for other reasons, they could be buying automobiles, they could be taking a trip to Hawaii, and nobody would know about it because this is not an open, full open disclosure. And that can happen. This would open up the books, make sure that everybody knows exactly what's going on. If you're going to file for state office, then this would open up the books to exactly where you get your money from and how you spend it.
So then essentially I could run for office and not me, but somebody evil version of me could run for office on exempt status, $5,000, and then take that and spend that money anyplace.
Currently, Mr. Chair, Chair Lynn, right now, I guess that would be up to your own moral aptitude on how you wanted to do that. But as far as disclosure with APOC is concerned, you do not have to report how you spend those funds.
Please continue.
Again, you know, we pretty much hit the nail on the head here of why I did that. That's what House Bill 5 did. It would eliminate Section G. Currently in disclosure law, take that away. Section G, which in a nutshell states that excess contributions, there's several things that are talked about in there, and Mr. Wright can go about explaining each of those in detail because we do also have to deal with House Bill 6. But bottom line is, It would allow for open disclosure on all campaign contributions.
Any questions? I see Reverend Coggill has the book out here.
I'm just catching up with him. He mentioned Section G, Mr. Chairman, and that's it looks like there are three things that a person filing exempt does not have to do. They have to sign a statement that they do not intend to raise or expend more than $5,000. So they do get to raise that kind of money, and that would be both primary and general. Period. Yeah. So it's just an affidavit on their signature.
And then if they were to raise $5,001, then at that point they have to make the same disclosure that the rest of us do.
Mr. Chair, they would have to go and they would have to file the standard paperwork that anybody who does plan on raising and spending more than $5,000 would have to do that. And again, just to reiterate, I can go through what Section G says. It's simply the date and amount of expenditures made by the candidate, the total amount of all contributions, including all funds contributed by the candidate, the name, address, date, and amount contributed by each contributor, and for contributions in excess of $250 in the aggregate during the calendar year, the principal occupation of the employer and contributor. So now, you know, again, as Representative Rosa so clearly pointed out, you could have a group with particular political interests, again, supporting a candidate and put three or four candidates up against him where they could do nothing but a smear candidate, and nobody would know where that money came from, or a smear campaign type of thing. Bottom line is, if you're going to, the public is more and more, been more vocal about full open disclosure, particularly for statewide candidates. That's what this law does, is it opens it up for full open disclosure.
Is there any downside to something like this?
Representative Lynn.
Other than for bad actors.
Representative Lynn, I cannot think of any downside to this except that, no.
Any questions from the committee?
Just,
yeah, Representative Roses.
To the chair, just to comment, the only negative that I can see, and again, it's a small amount because there aren't that many candidates each year that, you know, request the exempt status, but the unintended consequences would be there would be additional paperwork for the folks at APOC to have to deal with, but that's a minor consequence, in my opinion.
We haven't heard from APOC on that yet, but
that's right.
I think we're going to hear about what APOC has to say right now, Chair.
That was for the benefit, I know, of Brooke Miles, who I believe is online. Tom Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Tom Wright, Speaker, staff. I don't want to speak for Brooke, but Brooke and I have had numerous conversations about this legislation, and you know, in our conversations, and Brooke, correct me please if I'm wrong, she would rather see full disclosure. It makes their job a whole lot easier. You know, yes, it will entail additional paperwork, but the number of candidates who file the $5,000 exemption, you know, aren't that many. And just to carry a little bit further from what Representative Newman said, and I know we're focusing on this part of the bill right now, and I guess we'll continue that conversation since it seems to be the topic. One of the things Ms. Miles and I did discuss were the municipal candidates. At first, we were just going to have a blank $5,000 exemption, you know, or delete the $5,000 exemption for all candidates. Then we got into the municipal officers. We got into the constitutional convention delegates, which we haven't had yet, but they're also, you know, part of this, along with judges for judicial retention. Now, the judges, from my understanding, are barred from raising any money, expending any money, you know, by the Bar Association, but, you know, for some reason, they're still included within these statutes. So within the CS, we did allow an exemption for municipal officer or municipal candidates. If they're going to raise less and spend less than $5,000, they're still exempt under this bill, as are the constitutional convention delegates, as are the judges who are up for judicial retention.
Yeah, question from the committee?
So in the original version of the bill, G was repealed, but we modified G to allow for those exemptions, so there wasn't a repeal within the statute.
Anything you'd like to add before you have to leave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to add, with the implementation of mandatory electronic reporting requirements, this does take that burden of APOC with having to deal with the paperwork. It makes it a lot easier. So we do have electronic reporting now that's required. So the burden on APOC, I think, is reduced.
As I understand it, that's not required yet, am I correct, unless we perhaps incorporate it into this bill or some other bill. But potentially, if that were in this bill, that could ease the burden for APOC. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We are joined by Representative Grunberg. Any other questions? Thank you. We appreciate it. And it's good that you roll this into HB 6, I think, because, you know, we have something like, I think, 30 bills before this committee, and it makes it a little bit simpler to combine where we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for your consideration.
And this is an example of where we don't have pride of authorship in trying to get good legislation out.
And, Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I guess I'll proceed whatever manner you want me to proceed, I guess.
Well, why don't you proceed as you're going to do before, then when you get to Representative Newman's portion of this thing, just kind of go lightly over that.
Well, what I'll do then, Mr. Chairman, is kind of go over each section. There's six sections within the bill, and I can kind of outline those a little bit if you'd like. Section 1 amends 15-13-040A. This adds language, you know, that refers to elections for state officials only. This is part of the $5,000 exemption portion. You know, there's a number of sections that are related to that, and it just says that for election of the state legislature, governor, lieutenant governor shall make a full report, except as provided in L. And it requires date and amount of all expenditures made by the candidate, total amount of contributions, name, address, date, and amount contributed by each contributor, and for contributions over $250 in the aggregate, during the calendar year, the principal occupation employer of the contributor. Again, this is part of the this is conforming language to the $5,000 exemption for those municipal and other entities that we discussed.
Any committee on section one? We got one section out of the way.
That's good. Okay. We're moving right along.
Focus brings eternal.
Section two, what this does is require every group to report all contributions, whether they're less than $100 or not.
Representative Rogers, I think, had a question.
Yes. So in this section, for example, if there was a PAC out there, a union PAC, and currently if they collect political contributions and their aggregate is less than 100, they do not have to port the name and address of each of those individuals. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
With this bill, they would have to report it even if it, regardless of the amount?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. Not another question, but I have a little bit of a concern on this issue from the standpoint of, I don't have a problem with the disclosure, I don't have a problem with the reporting, but what I do have a problem with, having been in this capacity in the past, and is in working with a union organization, and as we collect political funds, what happened is there are always groups out there and individuals that want to get the name of every union member and their address, especially those organizations that are trying to bust unions, and some of the ones that are on the right to work issues. And so unions are usually very protective of their name and addresses of their members. And I think an unintended consequence of this would be to put all of those labor unions and organizations at a disadvantage in terms of trying to protect their organization. So I like the disclosure part of it, but if there was some way that we could create a firewall so that those names and addresses weren't published, but maybe they're on file with APOC, and if there was a question in terms of the integrity of the candidate or any concerns about the ethics of that candidate, then they could go in and those names and addresses could be reviewed. But to publish them where everybody could get them, I think, is a real severe unintended consequence.
Mr. Chairman.
If I might, tag on to that, it's not just the union groups, but the several groups out there involving the social issues, the pro-life, the pro-choice, all these different groups out there, and both sides of that equation might have the same difficulty. I believe Representative Cargill was.
You made my point, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I made your point?
Yes, sir.
By God. Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines, I don't know if this is a question or a comment, but it is my understanding that these contributions are voluntary and that we're not forcing anyone to contribute. And as long as everyone knows that that is the consequence of their contribution, I think that full and total disclosure is something we ought to strive for. And I think that if a penny goes to affect a candidate or an election, it should be reported.
And we're joined by Representative Johansson. Representative Cargill.
The sponsor could probably answer this, but we already require many people to give their name and address when they contribute. This just would open up another group of people who are affecting the outcome of public policy through election process. So, and maybe the sponsor could speak to it, but in filing APOC reports, I am continually putting the name and address and employers of many, many people, some of them who, for their support of certain candidates, have been boycotted. So there has been that kind of stuff that's happened. And yet, if people just like any of us who sit here who do get elected are going to have to face some public scrutiny, if the policy call of APOC is to say these are the people who are supporting candidates who affect public policy, then I suggest that either we do it for all of them or do it for none of them.
Mr. Chairman, I would not argue with that. Candidates right now are required to file every contribution they receive. And it's the Speaker's intention that we deal with full disclosure for anybody participating in the political arena.
Representative Roses.
Just to follow up on the comment that I made before, you know, I think the way, even if we go back to the ballot initiative that was just recently passed, I think an unintended consequence that occurred there. Again, I agree with the concept. I agree with full disclosure. I agree with reporting everything. On the APOC report I filled out, it said I didn't have to report any income under $5,000. I did it anyway. It said you had to declare gifts. I even wrote down every trip that I took using free mileage. Now, that's absurd, but nobody's going to question whether I did or didn't disclose. But I think one of the unintended consequences that we have, even of the initiative that the voters passed, is it requires individuals to report all their sources of income under a certain level. And I'll take the representative that was speaking before he left, Representative Newman. He earns his living in the interim building furniture and remodeling kitchens, building kitchen cabinetry. There's a bid process that's involved in that. Every one of his competitors will now know every job that they bid against him on, exactly how much he made and how much he bid. Because he's going to have to list every single name and address of everybody that pays him any money whatsoever. So what we've done as an unintended consequence, we have now put the position to where this guy is not competitive in his work anymore. Now, again, I believe in total disclosure. That's why I say I think we need to somehow, in the process, create a firewall where the information is there, but not necessarily listed to the public. There has to be some sort of concern or issue that APOC raises in terms of whether there's an ethical violation, whether they're doing work for a lobbyist or whether they're doing the work for somebody that is trying to unduly influence their political campaign by giving them work. And so, you know, that's, if we can somehow create that, I don't have a problem with either one of these, but we want citizen legislators. And if we're going to have that, we have to allow them to earn some kind of a living in the meantime. What we want to do is make sure that the bills guarantee that there isn't anything going on that shouldn't be going on. Somebody isn't being paid for something they haven't done, or somebody is being paid four or five times the amount that would be the normal rate that somebody would get because you're trying to influence. That's what we're trying to eliminate. But I don't think we're trying to eliminate somebody from working. And I think some of the unintended consequences that we're providing here may just have that exact result. So if there's some way we could create a firewall in there and give APOC the responsibility to review it and then bring it to the light of day if it's questionable. But so I don't know how we do it. It's easy to say, give us ethics. It's much more difficult to enforce it and to write something that's fair and equitable.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Roses makes a good point. But we are required to put down as legislators everything that we earn. We are under that close scrutiny. I think that it's the people that want us in office also should stand for that scrutiny. This is a little bit of soapbox, but
we do that here.
We have to, as a body, reinstill confidence in what we do. Citizens of this state have a right to know that when we come down here, we're making decisions in their best interest. The only way that we can do that is if they know exactly what's going on to the penny every time. The purpose of this ethics, I don't think anyone in this body is unethical. I believe that a large purpose of this is to reinstill confidence with the public in this body and its government. They have a right to know they put us here. They also have a right to know everyone who supports us to get here. I fully support this. I think every penny that goes to an effective election should be accounted for. The person who donated should be accounted for. And if we don't have full and open disclosure, I'm not sure we're serving our constituents in the state of Alaska.
The word trust has been used a lot. I've used it myself. And another part of trust is accountability. I think the public wants us to be accountable to a certain set of standards and so on. So I think accountability is very important. And whether this gets us to that point or not is open to debate, and which I'm sure we're going to have in a little bit. Any other questions for Representative Dahl?
Yes, I just need to understand more of the implications of this. For example, if a neighborhood group decides to hold a raffle, for example, or a bake sale for a candidate, and people come in and buy a raffle ticket, two for $10 or something like that, buy a tray of cookies, how is that reported? How is this going to affect that kind of?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand correctly, we have exempted that, you know, the raffle provisions and the you know, the bake sale provisions within this legislation. And again, I would probably defer to Ms. Miles regarding that question, but the way it was drafted, we wanted to make sure there was a deferment for that, because accounting for, you know, events of that type are pretty difficult.
I can spend a lot of money at bake sales, I'm here to tell you that.
Well, I think there's a few of us here that might have participated in one or two.
Representative Grinberg.
Just to follow up.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Representative Dahl.
Yes, at the time, I would like to have our speaker, who's going to be on the phone, I imagine, teleconference.
Again, please.
I would like to have that followed up with the woman who's probably on teleconference to answer the question.
Yes, Ms. Miles.
Yes, thank you.
I think this is one of the probably more controversial parts of this bill. Representative Grinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's really easy to categorize, quote, what the voters want, what our constituents demand. This hasn't been a burning issue, and I've been in this business for quite a while, with literally anybody I've talked to at the door. And nobody says, I need to know every single person who gives you a buck. On the income tax return, you can check off if you want a dollar to go to the presidential campaign. Can you imagine what this would mean if they did this at the federal level? Everybody who gave a dollar would have to disclose it. People here, I think, prize their right to privacy. And they feel if they give a small amount, and we all know we've had probably dozens, if not hundreds, of contributors in each campaign who give below a certain amount because they don't want to disclose it. I think there are far more people who want that privacy and want the freedom to give to a candidate without having to list it to God and the country than want to disclose everybody. There are few people who want to pry and find out everybody who gives everything for everybody. And a half of them are just interested, and the other, there are a small number of people who take reprisals. I think we all know people who have suffered reprisals, losses of jobs, business opportunities, because they have certain political beliefs, because they have supported certain candidates or opposed certain issues, and they need to be protected too.
Your response?
Well, I guess my response, Mr. Chairman, would be that, again, as Mr. Representative Johnson pointed out, this is voluntary. You want to participate in the electoral process by contributing, that is, no one is twisting your arm to do it. It is a voluntary process. All we're saying is there needs to be transparency within our disclosure laws. And if candidates have to report every dime of income, then, you know, the public has the right to know whether or not they choose to use it as to who is contributing to other entities who are participating in the political process.
Of course, here, you're talking about the candidate themselves, but what about the privacy of the person who makes the contribution?
Again, that, Mr. Chairman, that's up to the individual.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Coghill.
Well, we are talking about groups here. And what you generally would have as a group is a group of people who will pool their money to affect either the candidacy of an individual or a public policy call that's coming up on the ballot. So anytime you have people grouping together to affect an outcome of an election, then their purpose is very clear. And what I think was happening here is to say, who are these folks? You're demanding full disclosure of everybody else but these folks, if I understand correctly. And so why should groups who affect the outcome of an election be exempt when everybody else, especially candidates, I guess, would probably be the better way of putting it, have to disclose. So I understand that getting down to the privacy issue is very important. I guess I felt the same way when I signed up to be an elected official, both on financial disclosures and on campaign disclosures. who would support me. I found out some who thought I was too hot to handle. But on the other hand, I've also put out whatever my income capacity and entanglements are. So a group then banded together specifically to make a difference in the outcome of an election, then I think if that's the purpose, then they should be disclosed. Like I said, if the effect of this could be this, if I understand correctly. Under $100, you could have a steady stream of under $100 dollars coming from that are absolutely unaccountable. So a person could get, and I know that in some past history, you can check this out, I know of a candidate in the Fairbanks area that got over $30,000 of less than $100 campaign contributions. Nobody knew where they come from, but they were a huge effect on the efficacy of that campaign. And there's a lot of supposing where they came from, but they came from groups who were able to either get a whole bunch of people to put the money in, or a few people, and they assigned that amount to a lot of people. And we just don't know. That's the problem. We just don't know. So there's a lot of conjecture on it. But it does affect the outcome of elections.
Representative Johnson and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing that I think, you know, we're talking about people that contribute, you know, $99 or 50 cents or whatever it may be. But just as a point of information, the groups that we're talking about in the last election contributed two candidates and two issues in various forms, $3.4 million. That's a lot of money. And if it comes in $99, that goes a long way. It's 1.6 directly to candidates. That's a lot of money, and I think that the citizens of Alaska have a right to know where that money comes from. We're not talking about small chump change here. We're talking about huge amounts of money.
I remember on, was it the Prop 2 thing? We had it. And there was some controversy about who's giving to the anti-prop too, wasn't it? There's some controversy about who that was, and I guess eventually they opened that up. Am I correct?
On the cruise ship?
No, that was on the reserve tax.
They're all taxed. Representative Grunberg.
You know, bringing up a proposition really puts this in perspective, because there is no requirement that people who are for or against propositions disclose a dime. And if the public really has a right to know, they have a right to know who was against Proposition 2. That's far more important than who supported Max Gruenberg to most people in this state. And why are we being hypocritical? If somebody wants to open it up, let's open it up for everybody who's pro and con, everything. You know, otherwise it's just really for the use in a political race. It's not truly disclosure. It's just to be able to use it politically in a campaign, or for just a general interest in some manner. This is a very, very patchwork-like system of regulation. It's not truly disclosure for the public. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said, for example, that people can write editorials, and they don't have to disclose who writes the editorial. That's on a day-to-day basis. And that's just the opinion of one person in newspapers. People, political parties have a right to close our primary, a right of association. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that. And they don't have to disclose who's doing all of that. That's a whole group of people. But what real interest compared to that does the public have in knowing who gives a dollar to my campaign?
Mr. Chairman, I don't feel that we're being hypocritical in this bill. That is not our intent by any means. All we want is full disclosure for any group, entity. If you want to include proposition, I believe that AIPAC addressed the proposition groups or individuals have participated in the proposition, you know, as an informational campaign. But again, I don't want to speak for AIPAC as to why or why not they didn't have to disclose. If that is your wish to have those folks disclose, we would have no problem with that, Mr. Chairman.
And when the time comes, please remind us to ask AIPAC about that. Was it Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines, I would absolutely support that. I believe it should be fully disclosed. I think that's part of it. I think we were dealing with candidates in this one, but I'd be happy to get on that bill with you.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'd like to respond on that point.
On that point.
I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting, Zach, is exactly the opposite, that people have a right to privacy. And this bill, by not taking what would have been, if you really wanted disclosure, this bill would have had it in it. But I don't think this bill has it in it because it's not true disclosure that's wanted on all issues. It's just on some issues. Who supports a dollar to a candidate?
And I would support your amendment to this bill as well. The other thing I wanted to mention is Representative Grunberg, that you'd mentioned that parties have a right to association. You can go online and find out who belongs to a party. You can go to voter registration. That's public information. So that is out there. So I don't think that's a good analogy for a party to decide, because you can find out who's registered how on the Internet.
To respond on that point.
On that point.
That shows people who have voted and may have registered to a party in that sense. But there are people who support parties who are not registered to vote. There's nothing that requires everybody who supports the Democratic Party or the Republican Party to register to vote. You have a right not to do that.
Isn't it on his right to privacy? Those of us who run for office and who aren't, we give up a certain amount of right to privacy when we file all of our reports and so on. And I suppose the argument could be made if you contribute to a candidate or to a cause, you're giving up some right to privacy. But this is a very sticky wicket on the thing, because we do want to have appropriate disclosure. Yes, Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I think a lot of talk happens during political season about special interests. We have zeroed in on the Ethics Committee on lobbyists and the ethical behavior of our administrative executive branch. And here you have groups who really are special interests. And they have a huge impact on public policy. So I don't know if this is the perfect way, but I think you go down the road of saying, if you're going to be a special interest to affect the way the rest of the country has to respond to public policy, then we ought to know who it is that's making those calls. So I don't whether we should put the employer down there. I suppose that might be something I would be open to debate, but at least the individual who make the contribution.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Johnson.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have, along that special interest line, I think groups are special interests of all kinds. I've actually intend to propose an amendment which may or may not fly in this committee, which bans PACs from contributing to campaigns. So I think that takes a special interest out of it. If an individual wants to donate, we're going to have a citizen legislature. That is something I intend to do. I'm going to offer that up and see if it flies, because I agree we have to take special interest. We have to let the citizens of Alaska know that we're acting in their best interest and not the interest of some group or some set of groups, that we are acting from our heart and from our knowledge and on the best of our constituents. So if this body, if this committee decides to pass that amendment, this particular section becomes moot.
And when the time comes, I have to ask to better define what the purpose of a PAC is.
Right.
Okay. Any other discussion on this particular point?
Just one other thing, Mr. Chairman. I have, and this is anecdotal because it's secondhand, I've actually talked to a member of the body who had someone come in to their office and say, we can't have this. We can't have this banning of PACs because we will no longer be able to lobby. Well, what we have is lobbyists can't contribute. We've made that law. We have PACs that are donating so they can lobby, and I don't see the difference. I absolutely don't see a difference between a group coming in and lobbying that can contribute to a campaign or an individual lobbyist coming in and lobbying a legislator. I think they're the same, and when the time comes, I'll be happy to debate that.
Any other question? Would you like to continue? You going to move to another section? Or?
Yes, sir.
Are you sure?
I suspect we'll be coming back to this section.
Well, I suspect we'll be coming back to this too, Mr. Chairman. Section 3 deals, again, with the exemptions that are allowed or the entities or people who are allowed to file $5,000 exemptions. And in discussing this with APOC, again, if we held municipal candidates to the same standard, we would have a hellacious fiscal note. So, and again, not wanting to tell municipalities how to run their campaigns or how to how people should file, we decided to leave the $5,000 exemption in place for the municipal candidates, for judges seeking retention, or again, constitutional convention delegates.
Any questions on Section 3? Wow, we probably should stop right there, I guess. we've got one.
Could we add the Attorney General? Sorry, that was just...
I think if the Attorney General, if it ever comes to the point where we have to elect one, I don't think he... I think we'd have full disclosure requirements for the Attorney
that
General.
That is another topic.
That's right.
Thank you. Well, I'd light it up just a little bit.
Livening up is okay, but Section 4.
Section 4 deals with non-group entities, and what it requires, it does away with the aggregate of $250, and again, requires full disclosure for non-group entities. They have to list the principal occupation and employer of each contributor.
Okay. Question, sure. Section 4?
Yeah, for the...
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of us who came in late or have short memories, why don't you describe what a non-group entity is?
Non-group entity, I'm trying to remember now because I always get the two mixed up because we have groups, non-group entities, and candidates. A non-group entity would be something like, I guess just to use an example, and again, I'd ask Ms. Miles to correct me if I'm wrong, like the Alaska Conservation Foundation would be a non-group entity, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chairman, I have the definition right here.
Representative Cargill.
This is in 1513-400, number 13, non-group entity means a person other than an individual that takes action, the major purpose of which is to influence the outcome of an election, and that cannot participate in business activities, does not have shareholders, have a claim of corporate earnings, is independent from the influence of business corporations. So,
and could you explain perhaps the difference between a non-group entity and a PAC? Which is a political action committee?
Good question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to have Ms. Miles define
it,
please.
That's probably better.
Yeah. Should we ask Ms. Miles to comment now?
Would be better.
Ms. Miles, are you in line?
Good morning, Chairman Lynn. I am.
Good morning, Brooke. We had the question, or I had the question, what is the principal difference between a PAC, which is a political action committee, and what is a non-group entity?
Well, there's very little difference in the way the campaign disclosure law applies to them. The difference is the non-group entity was created after campaign finance reform when the Alaska Supreme Court's opinion stated that the law needed to provide some method from which these nonprofit corporations could have a voice in elections. So generally, the difference is that, and we only have one non-group entity in Alaska, and it is the Alaska Conservation Voters. And the difference is that their structure as a non-profit corporation does not permit them to be a PAC, to register as a PAC. They would have to have restructured. But Alaska law treats the non-group entity in the same manner, and has now for many years. Perhaps Speaker Harris's chief of staff can remember, but I'm thinking it was in 2001 or 2002 that the legislature created the, or maybe even 2000, the non-group entity section of the law. And under that, the entire purpose and intent was to treat this group, hold it at a minimum to the standards that is that are required from any other political action committee. And that's, I think that's what, I don't have the draft in front of me, but I believe you're talking about Section 4, and I think what the changes in Section 4 are to conform it with the changes to group disclosure. I hope that's responsive, but if you have additional questions, Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best to address them.
Right. So, for all practical purposes, am I correct? A PAC and a non-group entity, politically speaking, are about the same?
Yes.
It's just a matter of it's where they're put together. But a non-group entity and a PAC can and cannot do the same as a PAC can and cannot do. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you. Well, marvelous world of words. any questions for Ms. Miles? And there's Ms. Miles at APOC, by the way. Would you like to continue, please? Any other questions on Section 4? I learned something this morning. It's why I like this job. I learn something new every day. Section 5.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 5 limits PACs to no more than $500 a year contribution. Again, this is probably going to be one of the controversial portions of this bill, but the Speaker's belief is that PACs should be limited to the same thing that an individual can contribute. And again, if the members who belong to a PAC wish to individually contribute, they can contribute to the PAC. They can also contribute to the candidate of their choice.
And I had a question, if I might, here. We just, initiative, I believe, just passed that reduced individual contribution from a PAC was from 2,000 down to 1,000. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And so, if that's true, and I know it is, how can we touch that for the next 2 years? I thought you couldn't change the initiative for 2 years. You hear, the voters changed from 2,000 to 1,000, and now we, the legislature, are considering changing this from 1,000 to 500. How can that be,
Mr. Chairman? It's my understanding, again, and I'd have to defer to our legal folks. It's my understanding that we can amend to a lesser standard than or more restrictive standard in an initiative, within that time period.
More restrictive. Could we do the same thing with the cruise ship tax, for example?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding, yes.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Which one? Representative Grenberg?
You? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have any authority for that last statement?
Mr. Chairman, on the cruise ship, no, I don't.
No. For your
that's discussions I've had with Ledge Legal. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but that is my understanding, and I'll leave it at that.
I believe Resident Dahlin. Sorry,
I'll defer to Ms. Miles on this.
Again, please.
I'll defer to Ms. Miles in her opinion.
Representative Cobb, you had a question.
Well, I was going to suggest that we talk to the sponsor and ask for a legal opinion on that.
Sure.
I'd like to have one before we headed
before we
on a committee with this.
I think it'd be appropriate because I think
the parameters of amending or modifying an initiative.
Right.
You're walking off into some pretty tough ground there.
Right. And that's why I brought that up, because it appears, you know, the voters did pass this initiative, and it's my understanding that you can do very little with an initiative for at least 2 years.
And, Mr. Chairman, you know, to fully disclose, you know, we've had those discussions. I mean, the people I've talked to over at Ledge Legal say it could go either way. It's, you know, it's something that hasn't been tested, but, you know, the arguments could be made for both sides.
Yeah. I know from personal experience, I'm not Ledge Legal and Attorney General, and have opposite opinions on a particular subject. What is it? You get two attorneys and you get three opinions. which reminded Representative Grunberg, an attorney, of something.
But this is actually an issue of public policy. Don't you think it's good public policy, since we're talking about what is good public policy in this bill? If in doubt, defer to the initiative, because the initiative is one of the last vestiges of direct democracy in this society. And if you start creating precedents that undercut the initiative process, that's dangerous. And that really gets to the heart of direct democracy. Why is this so important that you should go up to the edge of the envelope, Mr. Wright?
Mr. Chairman, I think I explained why we took the route that we took. Thank you.
Representative Roses.
Through the chair, thank you. I guess I would have to disagree with the statement that it undercuts it. I mean, undercutting would mean that you would make it less restrictive, and this amendment would make it more restrictive. So I wouldn't see where it would undermine it or undercut it. But the that's all.
Representative Grunberg.
To respond to that point, again, we're dealing with the right of privacy and the right of association. And when the voters in the initiative took a balanced approach that allowed a PAC to give $1,000 people to associate for that purpose with the right of privacy, that was a considered view by the electorate.
Representative Roses.
Well, I guess my statement to that would be that if the ballot initiative had been written with $500, it probably would have passed. So the reason they voted for $1,000 is because that's the way it was written. It doesn't mean they wouldn't prefer $500. So
at this point, it's like arguing what the capital of North Dakota is when you look at a map. And I think I'd like to get some legal input on that before we go to whether we should or should not. The question is, can or can we not at this point, rather than should or should we not? Representative Coghill.
And Mr. Chairman, I might suggest to the sponsor of the bill that including in our packet might be the actual ballot language and the purpose intended. I think we might find some hope or some direction, I should probably be better said. In that, I honestly can't remember.
Mr. Chairman, I was just looking through here. You know, since we've had so many bills that are dealing with campaign disclosure, with ethics, I think in my House Bill 20 packet, I did have the initiative language, and I will be more than happy to get that for you and provide it.
I think that it would be just, Mr. Chairman, it would be good for us to be refreshed on that anyway, because stated before, there's going to be several amendments coming our way, and it's just going to be good for us to have that as part of our.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, we want to make hay slowly on this. I would like to get this or some version of this out of our committee no later than Thursday, because we have the big thing coming with HB 109, hopefully. The following week.
Yep.
So we'll have time to do this, I think. Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, the issue I don't think can be disguised by whether 500 is more, quote, restrictive or less, quote, restrictive than $1,000. The real issue is, what power has the legislature to amend an initiative within 2 years? And that issue is an issue that the legislature over the last 10 years has repeatedly confronted. This is not the first time the legislature has attempted to change an initiative within 2 years. And that is the principle that's at stake here, in my opinion.
Representative Roses.
I guess if the initiative said not more than $1,000, then $500 would not be more than, and certainly I don't see where it would be a violation. But if it said exactly $1,000, if it says $1,000, then I agree. But if it says not more than $1,000, then I don't see where we have an issue, because I think, having been a math teacher, I recall $500 is less than $1,000.
So. As a consumer, I know that. Representative Roses, excuse me, Grunberg.
If that's the case, then that same logic would allow us to eliminate the right of a political party to contribute entirely.
Well, at this point, I would like to have a radical idea of actually looking at the initiative and seeing what it says.
Mr. Chairman, there are copies being made now.
Representative Johnson.
I think this is an important issue that we need to deal with, because when we look at the cruise tax initiative, I don't know if any of you have started hearing any of this, but by taxing the gambling industry, we may have in fact condoned it and legalized gambling in this state. So that unintended, so is it, are we saying that we are not going to take a look at that? And even though the initiative said, yes, it's okay to tax gambling, therefore making it legal in the state, that we won't take a look at that one. I would be willing to bet we will have a totally different approach to looking at an issue when that one hits the table.
I can tell you something about this, because I'd asked some of these questions on this from Ledge Legal, saying that we could do this because it doesn't go to the heart of the cruise ship initiative. Or the Attorney General issued an opinion that says, yes, it does. So here we have, again, two very well-qualified legal people giving opposite opinions on something. And I didn't want to inject a whole other issue into this, because I had some concerns about the same thing, that by taxing gambling on cruise ships, that they would in fact open up gambling for the entire, for anywhere else in Alaska. And here we have Leslie was saying one thing and the Attorney General was saying the other, and I'm just a layperson.
Mr. Chairman, my intent was not to bring up
separate
issues, but to point out that...
since I had some special knowledge...
In a set of circumstances, we will be taking up...
But since I had some special knowledge on this, it's why I wanted... This is a great opportunity to make that... because I'm concerned about that other issue, which is not on topic here. Where are we? Mr. Wright?
Mr. Chairman... the last section provides for an immediate effective date. And copies of the initiative are being passed out now.
Okay, here we have a copy of the ballot measure 1 on campaign contribution limits, lobbying, and disclosure is being passed out to the committee. And would somebody help me find the appropriate portion of this thing?
I believe it's on section 2, number C, on this page right here, where it says...
Mr. Chairman, let me just read it for those who have the benefit of watching on Gavel to Gavel. It's section number 2, 15, 13, 070C, which is the very section we're dealing with. Says, a group that is not a political party may contribute not more than $1,000 per year to a candidate or to an individual who conducts a write-in campaign as a candidate, and number 2, to a group, to a non-group entity, or to a political party. So not more than $1,000 is as stated.
So how does that relate to what we said here, Representative Roses, being the math person?
Well, I guess my statement was that $500 is not more than $1,000.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Coggill.
This is not something I particularly want to fall on my sword over. I think the full disclosure elements of this bill are probably a little more important. So if if it comes down to a vote and it means the moving or killing of this bill, I probably will stick with $1,000 as long as we can get the full disclosure measures in it. So to me, that's the balance.
Okay. We're not there yet, but I suspect we're going to get there. Any question about the immediate effective date on this?
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only effect, immediate effective date would be on the Anchorage municipal elections. Is there some reason? I always, not always, but a lot of times I'm curious about effective dates. Is there a reason? Well, first of all, what is the effect of this bill on the current upcoming Anchorage municipal election?
Mr. Chairman, to be honest with you, I didn't even think about, or the speaker didn't think about, the Anchorage municipal race. The only reason we put an immediate effective date in so when candidates can start filing for office, we have the same set of rules in place, so we're not going to say 90 days hence from the governor's from the governor's signature, or a later effective date, is so that I believe I can remember what the filing date is, you know, for candidates, you know, to redeclare or declare their intent or actually file for office.
I think it's 18 months out.
I think it's 18 months out too, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman, so that we have the same set of ground rules, so we're not kind of dividing up, say, for this section of time when you're running, you know, you fall under this, and then, you know, at such and such a date, you're going to fall under these guidelines. It's so, you know, everyone knows what the guidelines are going to be once they file for office, and that's why we have an immediate effective date. There was no intent to try to change the rules for the municipal race in Anchorage.
Representative Roses.
Maybe I've misunderstood, but I thought that one of the beginning statements was that the municipal elections were exempt from this, that you're only dealing with state, or
Mr. Chairman,
apply to all sections?
That's the municipal candidates who file for a $5,000 exemption.
Okay, so that's a separate issue.
But if you're going to raise more than $5,000 or expend more than $5,000, you're still subjected to reporting requirements.
Any other questions on Section 6? Would you like to wrap up your portion, sections 1 through 6, and then we'll hear some public testimony and then give you a chance to do a recap after the public testimony, if you would care to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have much more to say. I think we've gone over the sections, and there has been a healthy debate regarding some of the controversial parts of this particular committee substitute. I wish to thank the committee for its time and look forward to further discussion, and I will have that legal opinion hopefully distributed as soon as I receive it.
Thank you. And I think I have some people I know. I'm wondering if perhaps we ought to hear from Brooke Miles at APOC, who is, I think, more or less neutral on some of the aspects of this bill, but to fill in any of the legalities we need to consider before we go to some of the pros and cons of these different sections. Brooke Miles, are you there?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Brooke Miles. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Mr. Chairman, I don't really have testimony to offer on this bill. The Commission's position, as usual, is a neutral one. There are many elements in this bill that are strict policy decisions that the legislature is elected to make on behalf of its citizens. That said, Mr. Chairman, I'm more than happy to address the questions you or your committee members may have.
Would any of these sections place, if they were to pass as is, would any of these sections place an undue burden on APOC?
I worked closely with Speaker Harris's chief of staff, Tom Wright, as he spoke to you in his overview of the bill. And I was mostly concerned about removing the exemption process from municipal campaigns. Currently, there are 31 municipalities that APOC is responsible for administering their campaign disclosure law. And
a majority of these communities file exemptions, particularly their school board members, and lots and lots, even in Juneau, most school board members file an exemption. I'd like to explain the process about the exemption a little bit. And that is, when a candidate signs that they will not raise or spend more than $5,000, that includes their personal money, it does not exempt them from the other provisions of the campaign disclosure law. For example, it does not mean that they can use any contributions that they receive for personal use. If they were doing so and a person had knowledge of that, they could file a complaint with the commission, and the commission would review the records, which are required to be kept by the candidate. They're only exempt from reporting. If they spend part of their $5,000 on an advertisement, it needs to be identified with those famous words, paid for by Jane Doe for school board, Box 10 Juno. So it's only an exemption from reporting. Tom Wright agreed to consider the idea of keeping the exemption for the municipalities, although removing it from state candidates, I felt that that a lot of that burden, a paperweight burden, had been removed. So I'm not seeing anything in particular in any one of the sections that's going to cause a whole lot more work for the commission and its staff.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Miles, representing Grunberg?
Ms. Miles, are you saying that if this bill passes in its present form in the CS, that people who are running for local office will be totally exempt from APOC's regulation?
People who are running for municipal office who choose to file an exemption, a statement, a sworn statement saying they will not be spending more than $5,000 in their campaign, will be exempt from reporting.
And that's the only thing they'll be exempt from?
That's right. They're still subject to the law.
Any questions for Ms. Miles? Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Ms. Miles. One of the questions that came up during the conversation of this bill is the reporting of those for contributions $100 or less, and the privacy issue came up. Under the existing reporting requirements, have there been complaints by those who have had their names on public disclosures about privacy?
We don't receive those complaints, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Coghill. It's a choice to participate in the election process. And there's really, once a person decides to do that and the state has disclosure laws, there's no presumption of privacy.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I complain. just for your ears. But I do it willingly, so well. I just wanted to know if you'd heard any backlash to the reporting requirements. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I believe Mr. Wright had some comment.
Mr. Chairman, just so there's no confusion, municipal candidates who are going to raise more than $5,000 or expend more than $5,000 currently under the law have to file with APOC. I mean, that's already being done. I think there was, it might have been left unsaid, and I just wanted to make sure that was clarified.
Any further questions here? From Ms. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, for Ms. Miles. Currently, you don't have to, as a result of the initiative, and previously, before 3 or 4 years ago, if you gave less than $100, I think, or was it less than $250, you didn't have to report. What was the figure, $100 or $250?
It was $100.
Okay. Can you tell me approximately what percentage of people who give to political campaigns give less than $100?
Actually, I don't have that information in front of me right now. I can get that for you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Groomberg. However, I do know when that law was changed that evidence in the most, and that was the 2002 gubernatorial election, there had been about $2 million contributed during that statewide election in under $100.
I'm not so concerned with dollar amounts, because it takes a lot of $25 contributions to reach, it takes four $25 contributions to reach the $100 figure. I'm more concerned about the number of people, the number of contributors, and I would be interested in knowing the number of people who are going to be affected, who now have a right to privacy, who won't if this passes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Under current law, there is no $100 batch 'em up. Everybody is reporting 100% of everything under current law.
I thought under the initiative, it went.
The initiative changed it for groups. Changed it back to a $100 aggregate, Mr. Chairman.
But it's still everybody reports even $1 contribution.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Tom Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Brooke, if you could you clarify that just for my peace of mind, I guess, as well as the committee's, that we did disallow or not or keep the exemption for raffles, bake sales, those types of things?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, yes. In working together with Mr. Wright regarding the provisions of this, it had been proposed to remove what we call the exempt fundraising section of law. And that is to deal with the low-cost, high-volume fundraising activities that can be from selling hot dogs on the park strip to selling T-shirts during the course of your campaign. And as we worked together on the bill, it was determined that it was best to keep that in. So if you have people attending a bake sale, and they don't spend more than $50 buying all that stuff, you get to just count the number of people who bought stuff and the total amount raised. And that's, you know, anybody who does spend over $50 at one of those events gets pulled out and named separately as a regular contributor.
You didn't even sell the T-shirts on eBay.
Now, that's a new one on me. I didn't know about that.
Just a thought. Representative Dahl.
Yes, so Ms. Miles, let me understand then. If there is a silent auction and a group has the silent auction and someone pays more than $100 or more than $50?
More than $50.
For an item, then the group must disclose who that person was that bought the item?
That's correct.
Okay. Any further questions, Mr. Wright? Reverend Johnson, and then Groomberg.
I just want to be clear that the initiative changed the fact that everyone had to report. So what this bill does basically reverts to pre-initiative language. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Reverend Groomberg.
I thought that, Ms. Miles, you just said that will revert for groups. So if you are contributing to a PAC, that PAC will now have to list your name. Currently, they don't. I think that's the change, or a non-group. It's only if you're going through one of these intermediaries that the bill will have an effect. Isn't that what you're talking about?
Oh, now excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I'm getting completely confused. My understanding is, before the ballot initiative, a group was required to disclose each contributor, regardless of the amount, by name and address. For those contributors who gave more than $250, they were also required to disclose them by occupation and employer. I might add that this is the same reporting threshold that you are all subject to as candidates, so that should sound kind of familiar to you. When the initiative passed, it put together the idea that groups could now aggregate their first $100 $100 from any contributor who doesn't give more than $100 can just be counted and shown on their campaign disclosure report as, and 10 people gave us $300 in that manner instead of by name, address, occupation, and employer. However, it now has established, the ballot initiative established another threshold. So under this, the people who give $100 or less can be aggregated and not named. But the people who give over $100, this is to a political group only, now have to be named, date and amount of contribution, name and address of contributor, plus occupation and employer, which is reporting at a lower threshold than all of the candidates are reporting occupation and employer information over a 250. Yeah. So this bill would move groups back to how they were reporting before the ballot initiative.
Thank you.
And again, that would not, in fact, we had an initiative, that would not keep us from doing that for 2 years?
You know, that is, Mr. Chairman, that's a complex area of law that I'm not really qualified to address.
Okay. We need to get this whole subject cleared up before we... Reverend Rosen, you had a question?
No, my question was answered. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Anything else, Ms. Brooke? Thank you very much. Please take your own if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, I would call Don Etheridge. Is still here? Morning, Mr. Etheridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. Don Etheridge here on behalf of the Alaska State AFL-CIO, and Representative Roses did an excellent job of covering one of our concerns about this piece of legislation. If we're required to list all of our members with their addresses and so forth, we have a major concern that that list can turn around and hurt the affiliates that are under the AFL-CIO. There's been several attempts in the past to get our mailing lists, our locals. They protect those with the utmost care. We don't even give those out to candidates that we support. In many, many years in the past here, we used to get whatever wanted to be mailed out, and we'd label it for them because we wouldn't allow anybody to have our membership list and mailing list. And if the intent here is to do away with a lot of the our organized PACs, this will do it. A lot of our groups will not keep their PACs if they have to put out their membership list. It's that sacred to us. And the other concern is the $500 limit. We think that seeing how we're contributing on a behalf of a number of members, that it should remain at the $1,000 limit. A lot of our members don't contribute to the PACs or anything else, so they don't get involved with it. So as it's been stated many times, it's strictly voluntary. And our locals just try to gather up some funds, and most of our contributions are $10, $20 a month, $25 a month that you see coming into our PAC funds from all of our members that contribute. So it's not like we're really making lots of money off of it. We do extremely express our concerns about having to give out our membership list, and that's our main issue right now, is that we wouldn't want to do that.
I want to, of your members, do you have any idea what percentage of the members do and do not contribute to your PAC?
No, each PAC is a separate organization, each local, and they keep that information. It's between them and the employers. Some of our locals have people that drop in and out every time they go to work for a different employer, they have the opportunity to sign. And that would be another major backlog in paperwork that we would see, is some of our membership will work for a dozen different employers in a year, bouncing back and forth. So when they're dropping in and out, they would have to keep filing that paperwork on that also.
Could you hazard a guess as to whether it's a substantial majority can make these monthly or make these contributions, or 50-50, or just any idea? Most people do, or most people don't?
It just depends on the organization, sir. Some of our groups are very active politically, and some of them just, they don't do hardly anything. Some of our PACs, they don't hardly make enough money to even make contributions. A lot of them stay under the $100 contributions because that's all they get. And so it varies depending on which local it is that's collecting it. I know some of our locals, they can't even get enough money to get a PAC together, so they don't even bother. So there's a lot of our members that don't get active at all. In fact, I'm ashamed at how many of our members don't even vote.
And, yes, Representative Roses.
Are there any of your locals where the contribution to the PAC is mandatory and you have to exempt out for it not to be taken out of your check?
Not in our locals that I'm aware of.
Okay, because I know for some there are. That is the case.
Representative Grunberg.
From individual members' point of view, how important do your members feel their privacy is in this matter?
I think many of them feel that it's really important. That's why they contribute to the PAC rather than contribute to the candidate themselves.
How do they feel about government intruding in their privacy in this matter?
Many of them don't like it at all.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
I can see a situation where for example, I had access, I knew who all your members were. In my campaign, I guess I could bypass your group and send a targeted mailing out to your membership with my own message if I knew who all these people were. Same thing, people know I'm very active in pro-life activities. And if I had access, which I do not, but if I had access to some of the pro-life groups' mailing list, I could send out mailing directly, and my opponents could do the opposite. Depending on what side of the issue you are on these things, either the proponent or the opponent of the thing could send out targeted mailings to the detriment or benefit of a candidate. This is a problem I see.
Yes, sir. And from my own personal view, we do contribute to candidates. And every time you do something like that, you wind up on so many mailing lists that it's unbelievable the stuff you get in the mail. I had to, this last election, I had to prop my mailbox up and with an extra post. There was so much junk coming in my mailbox.
I hope none of mine were in there.
No, sir. I paid close attention to yours.
Okay. You made a point. I'm concerned, about... If people have access to basically private lists, whether it's union groups or issue groups and so on, I can see where somebody could either use that as a targeted mailing in favor of something or a hit piece on various candidates. Representative Coghill.
Actually, I agree that anonymity in contributions is good. But we have decided that in the balance of issues, if you're going to affect public policy, we want to know who you are. And so we've moved it down to this level for groups. And when you start acting like a political party, and that is supporting candidates, getting money to them, and putting money into issues, I think that anonymity then needs to dissipate, because the public policy is being affected. And so that's what we've decided as a public policy call in Alaska at this point. So I understand the issue, but I also know, for example, the AFL-CIO has a huge impact with regard to who is running, how much they get, and what the issues are. And same with the Right to Life people. They'll go out and they'll recruit people, they'll try to get them support, and they'll try to get them elected. The same issue that a party does. And so I agree that I would like to see maybe a little more anonymity in some areas, but we have already decided that if you're going to affect the way a special interest affects public policy in Alaska, we're going to know who you are. And I don't know why this group should be any more exempt than, say, a party when they're doing exactly the same issue. So just for what it's worth.
Mr. Chairman, may I just respond?
Let's respond to that, then Representative Grunberg and then Representative Rosers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the overall picture of what effect the AFL-CIO has, the few dollars that we're able to put out isn't as effective as the manpower that we're able to put out. Our manpower, we don't have to report that anywhere. If we got our people going out to volunteer on your campaign, that's not reported. If our people are walking out here carrying the signs on the street, that's not reported. And that's more of an effect than the few dollars that the AFL-CIO can actually put out. In the general overall picture, we don't put out that much money. But what we bring to the table is manpower. And that's, if we can't do money, then I foresee that we're going to have to change our strategy and go to more manpower and less money going to the out. And I know there's a lot of our locals, once they write a $1,000 check, they figure, well, my part's done. Yeah. Well, if they can't write a $1,000 check, we're going to have to do something different.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll just have to attest to their effectiveness in that manpower issue.
Well, I would think so, and I think that, you know, a lot of money does go out to different candidates, and I don't know what the definition of a lot of money is. It depends on the beholder, I suppose. I believe you are next, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. That was where I was segueing into with my question. We have a lot of groups that are extremely powerful in this state, and there's conservation groups, the NRA, pro-choice, pro-life, all kinds of women's political caucuses, various associations, and if everybody who gives a dime through a PAC has to contribute, why shouldn't everybody who's a member of the NRA have their name listed?
I don't think you represent the NRA, do you?
No, sir. I give up my membership.
The point.
Representative Rosers.
Thank you, through the chair. There's one statement that you made that I wanted to follow up on, and that's the fact that you said most of your members give, you know, $25 or $10 a month. But I think currently in the reporting, if it's over an aggregate of 100, they already have to report the name, don't they? So I guess my question would be, what percentage of your members currently contribute less than $100 a year? Because this is the only ones that would be affected by that. So if they're currently over 100, you're already having to report. So.
Right. Many of our members... my local, I think you'll find that the average up from my local is around $3 to $6 a month that they contribute. So that's a lot of $3 as it's going to have to be counted.
Representative Dahl.
You know, I, for one, am very interested and eager to have more people involved in the political process and be involved in the elections and involved in electing candidates. And I know that confidentiality is a very, very big important thing. And we know that there's a lot of apathy out there, and we're trying to get people to participate and involved in this. And I do believe this is a very poor policy decision to have to disclose this kind of thing. So I would very much side with you on this and oppose this.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Etheridge? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have, I'm trying to read this, is it Tim Brady, is it, or?
Tom Bright.
Someone help me read this.
Here's your glasses. Tim, Tim Brady.
I couldn't see my glasses, I didn't have them on.
Here. Representing.
We have a mystery.
He's just a witness.
Oh, just a witness. Okay. You're on the wrong list. Okay.
I have somebody here from.
Yeah, he probably won't testify in the other bill.
Tammy Kempton.
Do you want to testify? He says no. Grab your glasses.
Get out of here.
Here, borrow.
Okay, Tommy Kempton, are you here? That's for the APOC, I believe. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Anybody online to testify? Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Okay. If not, I guess we can close public testimony at this point and get on with it. How does the committee want to proceed? Do you want to debate this line by line at this point, or do you want consider various amendments at this point? What's the pleasure of the committee? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the sponsor bringing in the initiative language. I would prefer to have some legal opinion, at least if it's arguable on both sides. I'd like to know what the arguments may be. So
this is the argument whether we may or may not lower the contribution rate.
Yes. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would, before we start amending, I would like to see that. So I'm going to suggest.
What's that? Yes. I've just been informed by my informer that.
not an informant.
that Tam Cook is in the audience. Would you, I see you back. Would you care to make any general comments at this point?
Tam? What's he, Tam?
No, she's not here.
No, Tam's
not. She's not here.
Oh, she's not here.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would suggest, though, that we get something either from her or from Ledge Legal.
I would think so, too. The other portion of this bill that really don't go to that part.
At the risk of not endearing myself to the Speaker's office, I would respectfully request that we hold this over.
Well, I plan to hold the bill over.
Well, without amendment, because just for that very reason.
Okay. Well, would some of the amendments really wouldn't go to the heart of this? I don't believe.
As you wish, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out the best way to handle it. Representative Johnson, did you have there is an issue on this? Let me find it here. On electronic filing, would you
thank
want
to thank you. I'm not sure if that's the appropriate place. Electronic filing is. This is the appropriate place for that. I had that prepared.
You said is or is not?
Is not. I'm not sure that's not better in 109 that the governor bill has got. So I'm not sure that's appropriate. The other amendment that I wish to offer, I think, goes to the heart of the legal opinion. If we can't change it to 1,000, how can we ban it? So I think I'd like to wait for the legal opinion because it may be moot or it may not be. So I think that if we can't go from 1,000 to 500, we certainly can't ban it.
Yeah, I had planned to hold this bill anyway, but I just want to make sure if there's some less controversial parts of the bill that we might.
There is no no section that is not controversial, Mr. Chairman.
I'd be happy to offer my amendment, but I think it does go to the heart of the initiative, and we should get an opinion.
Well, I think this is a very, very important bill. Now, obviously. And we want to have as many disclosures as we possibly can. The key word here is accountability. We want to have good law without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We want to protect privacy whereas we can, although as candidates we give up a certain amount of privacy when we decide to run for office. And if we were not comfortable with that, then none of us would be sitting at, at this table. So with that, I'm going to hold this bill until Thursday. And if you have any amendments pertinent to this bill, I would like to have you get those amendments to my office and to the other members of the committee as soon as possible, so we have a chance to look at these bill amendments, rather, before we get to the table here. That would be a great help to all of us. So with that, I'm going to hold this bill until the next meeting. And on a slightly different subject, Representative Coghill, could you give us a mini report for the benefit of our viewers on Gavel to Gavel and any other media, the progress of the subcommittee? And also, I have here, it looks like, a memorandum of a partial CS. Is that correct? Just give us an update when you plan to meet next and where we are in the process and potential time schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the subcommittee met Saturday for just short of 2 hours, which seemed like 4 hours. But we did wade through Title 24, which is the legislative ethics issue.
I believe AP described it as wading through a thicket, and I thought it was rather well put.
And the way one of the ways I described it is it's like assembling a bicycle. There's a lot of parts to it, I think, but once we get it assembled, we'll have a very clean operational report for the committee with suggestions from the committee that will have sort of the blander version, but we'll have hammered out some of the issues. Some of the more controversial calls we'll probably leave for the whole committee. We got through most of the Title 24, which is the legislative ethics, and the memo you have before you is requesting the drafter, Mr. Wayne, to give us a CS to the work to date. We plan to meet again Thursday at 5 o'clock.
And the public is noticed.
Public will be invited.
Public welcome.
And we'll be, once again, I think, in the speaker's chambers so that we have that big desk we can lay everything out.
That's assuming the speaker's still speaking to you.
Yeah, that is assuming he still allows me to enter his office. The idea there will be to not only take up some that we laid aside so that we could do further work on them, finish out Title 24 and go into the ethics part of the executive branch. If we can at all possibly get that done Thursday, that will be fine. But my intention is, if we don't finish it out Thursday, is to have another Saturday meeting so that we can have things drafted for report out of that committee to you on Tuesday morning.
Okay, because I would like, I want to bring 109 to the table. Other than the gas pipeline, I think this is probably the most important legislation we're going to be doing this year. Because, again, it establishes a level of trust, establishes accountability with the people on it, and I want to press forward with it. And so we can perhaps anticipate hearing the full committee hearing this bill, part of it, on a week from today. Is that correct?
If you ask all the staff members of each one of the committee members, we have not been wasting time.
No, and I would verify that. And as I said, I was at that subcommittee meeting, not participating. I'm too smart for that, but I was watching. And my hat's off to the Representative Coghill, Representative Rosen, Representative Johnson for the
Grunberg.
I beg your pardon, Grunberg, for the great work you're doing there.
Johnson too.
And Johnson too. All God's children.
May I make a comment?
Yes.
When the chair of the subcommittee first announced that we were not going to put anything into the bill unless it was a unanimous decision, I quite honestly didn't think we'd get anything in. Because to get a unanimous decision on anything, even if there's only three, I didn't think would happen. But as the process moved forward, I wholeheartedly agreed with that because, the complexity of what we're doing, we have to have strong support for it if it's going into the bill. So even though I had a little bit of a grimace and the muscles in my stomach tightened up a bit when you said that, it got a little more relaxed as we went through it. So I think it was a good process. But on the Thursday meeting, I would, if there's any way that we can work through that to avoid a Saturday session, I'd appreciate that, because we have, I have scheduled 2 weeks ago a public safety conference in Anchorage for dealing with gang-related issues and dealing with the narcotics division, and an overview from several of the other agencies that are involved as part of that subcommittee. So if we can avoid Saturday, that would certainly be to my
interest. Okay, I'll check with your schedule to see what we can do.
Okay, and how many different how many bills do we have altogether we're trying to put together in some fashion, and plus amendments?
Mr. Chairman, there's probably 13 different bills, and
13 bills.
And there was about 50 different language set differences that we were considering in
potential amendments
in four different titles. And so, and when I say titles, that's section title 11, section title of the Alaska statute, section title 15, 24, and 39. So,
yeah, very good. That one of the smartest things I've done so far in 4 years is appoint that subcommittee, because trying to put that together on the full committee would not have been good. Representative Grunberg, then I want to press ahead, get your bill on the table here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for both of those. On behalf of the House minority, I'd like to commend the unanimity rule.
Yeah, well, thank you. Representative Cogger.
And worthy of commendation it is, because that was something that him and I agreed on.
There you go.
I wish we did it all on all bills.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I was.
So do we.
There's a headline. With that, okay. Thank you, Representative Cogger. Representative Grunberg, would you like to introduce CS? H-88, and we'll be adopting a CS for that.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Wait till you get to the seat. Yeah. Oh boy. So just give us the basic purpose of this bill, and then we're going to see about adopting a CS. The basic purpose of the bill, and then we'll see about adopting a CS you have here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief, because we have somebody on the phone from the East Coast, and if we can allow him to testify today, then that will be a real help to us. House Bill 88 is a bill that we introduced last year. A number of us, including you, were co-sponsors. It passed the House and did not pass the other body, for I think reasons basically unrelated to the bill. It is a bill that arose out of a tragic accident in which a couple died when another car crossed the center line and hit them. The allegation in that case pointed up a problem that people cannot watch DVDs and TV monitors in their cars and drive safely, and that should be prohibited. And normally you'd have to prove negligent driving in a circumstance like this, and this makes it a crime if you simply show that you have a vehicle. The original bill, if you have a vehicle that has one of these TVs or DVD players installed and it's operating, where it can be viewed by the driver. It doesn't make a difference if the device cannot be viewed by the driver while the vehicle is being driven.
That's in the backseat to entertain the kids.
That's okay. And that was the original bill. We have a proposed CS which expands it a bit as a result of discussions in the Senate and discussions over the interim. And I would like to lay before the committee, in my capacity as a member of the committee, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The marked up C version. This was a version that we just got yesterday afternoon, and the comments, the changes on it, pen and ink, are mine to clean up the language a bit and to make it a little more specific. And before getting into the details, I would like to see if we could take, in the few remaining minutes, Mr. David Weiser, who who was the son.
First of all, I'd like to have you, do you want to move the amendment?
Thank you.
It's not an amendment, it's yes.
Move for discussion only.
And I object for discussion.
The version, work order 25LS0312/C, lockup 21207, with the pen and ink corrections.
Do you have that over there? Again? Yes, I've objected for discussion purposes. You want the gentleman back east to testify?
Yes, by the way, I'd like to introduce Mr. Norman Cohen, my assistant, who will accompany me and fill in the knowledge gaps.
Well, and that Mr. David Weiser, that's the gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. David Weiser, welcome to House State Affairs Committee here in Anchorage, in Juneau, Alaska. Will you identify yourself, please?
Yes, thank you. My name is David Weiser, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, please let me thank you for the chance to speak in support of this bill.
And where are you located, sir?
Where am I located?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I've relocated to Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay, thank you.
Where I've been living since, I guess, a three-year return after college.
Thank you.
I did return to Alaska after college. I have a brief statement, if I may.
Continue.
On October 12, 2002, my parents, Bob and Donna Weiser, were killed in a horrible and fiery car crash when they were hit head-on traveling southbound on the Seward Highway. Charges of second-degree murder against the other driver were levied when the Alaska State Troopers had determined through investigation that he was, in fact, driving a pickup while watching a movie. In the subsequent trial, the driver was acquitted of all charges. This was a trial that had garnered national attention, and it was dubbed the so-called murder trial. At the end of that trial, he was acquitted. You as legislators are, in my belief, working on the vanguard of legislation in an area that is all but uncontested and, in my belief, apolitical, that of our collective safety on the roads of the nation. Full motion video is now available in my market on handheld phones with screens the size of two thumbs side by side, and video iPods are everywhere, layering the difficulty that you all now face in structuring a bill. I ask, what societal benefit can possibly be provided by people watching full motion video in the front of a vehicle, specifically the driver? None, really. We all have to drive the roads of our nation together, and there doesn't appear to be any corporate opposition to placing limits on the ability of people to do what I mentioned above. The driver of the other vehicle began his defense boldly, stating through his attorneys, and I paraphrase, "Yes, I installed the DVD in the front of my truck. Yes, I wired it in such a way that it could work while under motion. And guess what? There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing specifically illegal about that. Why did I wire it that way? It was easier." Basically, he thumbed his nose at us, the family that had just seen the sad deaths of our folks. Your ability as legislators to prevent that type of affront to future families is what is probably most at issue here. The jury found reasonable doubt that he was watching the DVD and therefore caused the crash. And that is the burden of the state of Alaska to overcome in a murder trial. But I've said it before that I believe that the burden as legislators is a reasonable belief that he was, or more importantly, that others do and are doing so every single day. And in reaching this conclusion about him and others, you all have the power to prevent the type of upheaval that our family suffered in the wake of an acquittal. You have essentially the power to set an example for the nation. It is common sense that one should not be driving while watching motion video, but when that which is common sense not to do becomes totally commonplace, marketed by manufacturers and even idealized in television programs like MTV's Pimp My Ride, it really does fall to the nation's legislatures to influence and, when necessary, provide the mechanism by which the police, district attorneys, prosecutors, and juries are able to severely punish people's actions, especially when they result in injury, serious injury, and, in our case, horrible deaths. My parents were on their way to the Kenai Princess Lodge to celebrate their retirements, which were supposedly upcoming in 2 weeks. They never made it. They were young, 26-year residents of the state of Alaska, grandparents, law-abiding citizens, and I estimate that over 450 voters attended their trial. We as a family ask that you all try to support a bill of whatever structure, because it's about protecting Alaskans just like my parents, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
First of all, I'd like to express my personal condolences, and I believe I speak for everybody in the committee in expressing committee condolences to the tragic thing that happened to your family. And hopefully we can work on this bill to the point where we can make it safer for the rest of us driving in Alaska, so none of the rest of us will have to suffer the same misfortune that you and your family has suffered.
We thank you very much, and specifically for taking up this particular issue, which unfortunately legislation has really not been able to keep up with the pace of rapid technological developments.
Any questions, Mr. Weiser? Thank you, sir. When are you coming back to Alaska?
Well, I get back every once in a while. My brother and I own Marty's New York Bagel Deli in Anchorage. We brought fresh bagels, New York style kettle boiled fresh bagels to the state of Alaska for the first time.
Good marketing. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony, and I certainly understand where you're coming from on this. Thank you. Representative Grinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you for the promotion here.
I don't know if the speaker will be speaking to me now.
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to walk through the bill. I know that you were going to say something.
No, I just got it. We have approximately 5 minutes, so I don't want you to get too deeply into this.
Okay. Well, we have several other people here who may not be here afterwards. We have the lieutenant from the state troopers. Maybe I could yield to him.
Yeah, well, why don't we do that since he is here?
And we also, I don't know if he wants to come up with Lauren Rice, who's the legislative liaison for public safety.
If you'd like to come on up at the same time, that'd be fine.
Mr. Chairman.
Your Representative Johannes Granson.
Just want to note before we get going, the officer is a resident of District 1, so we'll treat him extra special.
Okay. He's That's not one of my constituents, though.
Not mine.
He's yours.
I'm wearing a badge, though. He may have a gun.
Welcome, Lieutenant Dial. Appreciate your service, sir. Any comment on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would just like to say the Department of Public Safety fully supports this bill for just the reason that was mentioned by the person who had called in. This essentially will allow us to charge a criminal offense for violation of this, where in the past we've just been able to charge essentially an infraction with a fine. So I would just be available to answer any questions that anybody may have on this.
May I?
Representative Grinberg.
We don't really have time to go into this in detail, and I hope the next time, if you're not here, you'll be by telephone. We had a discussion last night, a group of us in my office, about the bill, and you've made some very specific changes that you were suggesting that were good changes here. If I may just sort of move quickly. One of the things that, and I'll walk everybody through this thing a little the next time, but just so the people can know the changes we made to the House passed bill. On page 2, line 2, you can't now be watching a program or reading from a visual display on a portable cellular telephone or PDA. Do you want to tell us why that's important?
through the chair, Representative Grunberg, full motion video is going to be distracting whether or not it's permanently mounted to the vehicle or whether it's in a handheld phone. And we're just looking to basically expand and to say that watching a video while driving down the road is not acceptable in any format.
And I know when we get into debating this bill, there's going to be some enforcement difficulties with this, trying, you know, because you're in your trooper vehicle and this person in their car, and how can you tell that they're looking at a handheld thing? But we'll get into that later.
And I have a Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah. Would you please, I'm sorry, would you please state your full name and title for the record over there?
Yes. My name is Rodney Dial, D-I-A-L. Title is Lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers.
Thank you very much, and I apologize to our clerk. She's trying to get me straight here, and she's helped a little bit so far, but I have a lot to learn. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We discussed the potential difficulties in enforcement, did we not? Would you tell us how you're planning to enforce that provision?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg. Yes, certainly there are some difficulties. Things that we would start with was visual observations by both the police, witnesses, passengers in the vehicle, interviews, forensic examination of the equipment, if that is feasible, seizure of the equipment, application of search warrants, and so forth.
Thank you.
We also discussed and we distributed an amendment, potential amendment, a standalone amendment, a C1.
Which we'll have to do at the next meeting.
Yes. But just since we have Lieutenant Dial here, dealing with provisional driver's licenses and the use of wireless phones, would you tell us what the benefit of that amendment would be?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. Essentially, our most young and inexperienced drivers who are operating under provisional license, the thought is that we need to limit their distractions in any means so that they can gain that experience and drive safely. And one way to do that would to be prevent those individuals from operating a cellular phone while driving a vehicle.
Ms. Wright, do you have any comment? Thank you very much, President. And again, we appreciate your service, sir. Well,
one question.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where do the in-dash mounted Magellans and GPS locators fit into this? I mean, they're monitors, it's moving video, and they're computers. And I see that, according to what I read here, those would be banned?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, no, those wouldn't. They're specifically exempted under this bill and under current statute.
Oh, I see navigation and global position. Okay, I see that now.
Mr. Chair?
But yes.
Those are exempted under page 2, lines 13, and then maps on 14.
Mr. Chairman, I rented a vehicle when I was back east that actually had a Magellan and a slot for a DVD mounted in the car so that you could play a DVD over your Magellan. Hmm. And so I'm wondering, does that limit the whole Magellan, or, I mean,
we might want to look at
those are questions that I just
right,
need
right,
to
right.
have.
Yeah. We may want to investigate what rental cars policy is here on that. If any,
it was the Dodge Caravan.
Any of the people who rent cars in the state of Alaska, do they have such capability?
That's a good question.
We'll have to be looking at that.
And Mr. Chairman, my research indicated that at least 38 states have or are working on legislation of this nature. And I believe that some of those manufacturers that you discussed, when you do put in the DVD, it is not functional while the vehicle is in drive.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And you didn't want to ask your constituent a question, Reverend Johansson?
How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I would like to say one thing.
Yes, quickly.
This potential amendment, a number of states are going in this direction, too, for provisional drivers. It's a standalone amendment.
Thank you very much. Cindy Casher, are you here? Did you have any comment?
No.
Fine. Thank you very much. Anything else to come before the committee? If not, I'd like to thank you for your participation today, and House State Affairs Committee is adjourned at 10 o'clock. Everybody have a good day.